Thanks, Eileen. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Wash your hands.
Thanks, Dermot. Good afternoon on this Wednesday afternoon. How are you? 51551 for your texts. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Catherine's been on already. She says, after listening to Conor Creighton on your show yesterday, I downloaded his book on Audible, listened to it all, and thought it was brilliant. Very insightful and helpful, particularly as it was written during this pandemic. Thanks, Catherine. And the Conor Creighton, C-R-E-I-G-H-T-O-N, This Is It is the name of the book. Conor teaches meditation, and he spoke to us yesterday at length about meditation. You see, you assume that everyone knows what it is, so we attempted yesterday to explain what it is and what it does to you and why you should do it and all those things. And one of the big things about mindfulness and meditation, and they're not the same, is living in the now. And I'm trying to do that. There's no past, there's no future, there's only the now. Live in the moment. And we all know that at an intellectual level, but to actually do it in practice is a lot more difficult. So I was coming back from brushing my teeth, which I do every day before the show, and I noticed the huge cherry blossom tree outside the window of the office here in RTE. And I took a moment, I stopped, and I was in the now, and I absorbed the beauty that is that cherry blossom tree. And it was just a moment, like we're talking 5-10 seconds, but Something happened. So I'm just going to try and do that more. Be in the present. Be present. Be mindful of what you're doing, whether it's eating or walking or running or cycling or in a conversation. Be there. Be there, not somewhere else. Not be thinking about the future or the past or what you're going to say next. Now, you know, I'll try it for a while, see how I get on. I'm going to go back to the book because I read it in a hurry. And I highly recommend that you read it because it's a memoir. So it tells Conor's story, and he's led a very interesting life, a lot of which we didn't get to. Like, he was a war reporter in Afghanistan. He was a barman in the kitchen. That's U2's nightclub back in the day. And he's been all over the world and done retreats with various meditation gurus. And it's all laid down there. And it's really well written in that it's in the vernacular. It's very accessible. And he sets up each aspect of meditation for you, how it works for him, how to achieve it, what he felt when he did it first, all those things. So it's a great book. So Catherine obviously liked the Audible version of it, and he has a great speaking voice as well. It's a great speaking voice. Yeah, that's sad news about Jim Steinman, isn't it? Yeah, and I know Ryan played all the tracks, but back in 1977, that's when Bat Out of Hell came out. I was 13, 14, and I wasn't a big rock fan, but there was something about Bat Out of Hell. There was just something about it, wasn't there? I'm smiling already. Sirens are screaming and the fires are howling. We're down in the valley tonight. There's a man in the shadows with a gun in his eye and a blade shining no so bright. There's evil in the air, there's thunder in the sky. I wonder would Jenny and the children mind if I went home tonight and played that full album loud in the room. You would have to ask for the permission, really, because they share the house with you. Anyway, Jim Steinman, RIP. And of course, he was the creative force behind Meatloaf. And did I dream this? Somebody might put me straight on this. Did I dream it? Did I go to a Meatloaf concert in a hall in Carlow at some stage? If you were there, 51551. Maybe I dreamt it. Maybe it's some mad dream that I had. Now, we have Conor Pope on every Monday to deal with consumer issues, but I'm going to tell you a little story now. It's a cautionary tale. It's a tale of buyer beware. And it's that phrase that Conor uses over and over again. If it seems too good to be true, then it is too good to be true. And anyway, so a few weeks ago, I run a little bit. I might have bored you with that fact. And the runners are looking the worst for wear. And what happens is that the soles sort of cave in. So it's not advisable to keep running on them. But they're a good pair. Brooks bought them a year and a half ago when we were doing the 5Ks around the country. And they've come to the end of their day anyway. So I need a new pair. So I went on Brooks, put in the Brooks and looked and blah, blah, blah. And there they were. But it's an old model. And when you're buying stuff, I'm always cautious about buying the new model because sometimes it's not as good as the old model. Anyway, desperately searching around the internet for the old one, seemingly it was a Revel 2, Brooks Revel 2 runner. Eventually, it wasn't on the official Brooks site, but it was on a site that looks like the Brooks site. Brooks are a runner company. A lot of people wear Brooks. I see them a lot around. And there they were for €53, which alarm bells should have been ringing, because on the official Brooks site, the new version was €110. But I just thought to myself, because they're the old version, maybe that's why they're €53. So, of course, I clicked on, and not only were they available there, but they had it in 14 colours. They had 14 colours they had it in. So I said, right, I'll go for grey this time as opposed to black. So PayPal or whatever it was, off it went. Looking forward to the delivery of my brand new runners. Then something else happened that I should have been, the red flag should have been waving in my face. Didn't get one of those confirmation emails back to say, you have ordered this and here's how you can track it. You know, the way you do. So that didn't arrive. Didn't think too much about that. And then weeks passed, like a number of weeks. And then I thought to myself, this is a bit dodgy now. So I checked my bank statement to see if there was money taken from my account. And there was. So there was a website address which I put in. Nothing came up, which more odd. And then alongside it was Fu Su Shi, FuZhouShi. So I put that in, and as far as I can figure out, there is a city in China called Fu Su. And it turns out, now maybe I went down some sort of rabbit hole, it turns out that they're famous, if famous is the word, for making counterfeit runners. And then I landed on this video report from Vice. And there was a guy who travelled all the way out there, met this guy who used to be a medical student in the UK, discovered that there was huge money to be made making counterfeit runners, went back to his home country of China and is now making a fortune. And like, they're not cheap, well, they are cheap compared to the originals, but say, like, we spoke about runners a few weeks ago that you'd pay €1,300 for. Well, I wouldn't, but some people do. Well, you could buy the counterfeit version for €120. Anyway, so I thought, that's it. I'll get a pair back and they'll be counterfeit for sure. I can wear them during the summer or whatever. I won't wear them running. Anyways, this morning, package outside the door, wasn't a box, so I thought that must be something for Kate or Tom or something like that, a hoodie or something like that, and picked it up, and then I could feel that it was actually runners. So I opened it up, and there in the plastic bag were these blue things that looked like glorified slippers. No mention of Brooks. They didn't even try to copy them. So somebody in Fusu just sent me over a pair of runners. I haven't tried them on yet. And they look like something that you buy in a bargain store. You know, when the baskets with the runners just in bags, plastic bags, and then the marker has the 42, 43 for the size on it. That's what it was. Now, there's no point in me sending it back. I'm never going to get that money back. So I'll have to put it down to experience, and I'm passing it on to you. So buyer beware. If it seems too good to be true, it is too good to be true. And you think I would have known that after all these years of listening to Conor Pope, but there's something in human nature. I just thought, everything was, all the stars were aligned and I was getting the runners and there you go. Sorry, but no. Anyways, lovely story in the papers today about Sam, the Trinity Fox. So there's loads of urban foxes around Dublin, I'm sure around Cork and Galway and other urban areas around the country. They come into the cities to get the food. Now, during lockdown, of course, no students in Trinity, so there was less food for poor little Sam. So became sort of mangy, health deteriorated. So staff at the college took Sam in and took care of it. And then Prince, a fox named Prince, arrived on the scene. Sam being a female fox, Prince being a male fox. They've procreated. And now there's a lovely video doing the rounds, which you've probably seen, of Sam walking around Trinity College, followed by at least five cubs frolicking on the grounds of Trinity College. That's a lovely story. And then you might be interested in doing this, because we're all looking for a bit of diversion and something productive to do during lockdown. And as you heard, we don't know when we're going to be able to travel, even within the country, never mind outside the country. So NUI Galway and the National Biodiversity Data Centre are doing the Irish Hedgehog Survey. It was in the paper today. They did one last year, but last year they did it just on sightings. This year they're getting a lot more sophisticated, and they're going to furnish you, if you decide to be involved, with instructions, with tunnels, with ink, all sorts of things. So you'll be putting these tunnels in your back garden. the hedgehogs will come along in the middle of the night and they'll walk on the ink. I think that's the way it works or something like that. So they're looking for people. IrishHedgehogSurvey.com. I was thinking, I can't remember the last time I saw a hedgehog. It was years and years ago back in Kildare. And there's good reason why you don't see them, because they're nocturnal animals. They're mainly in hedge grows and woodlands, but you would find them in gardens, but they'll always be there at night and they disappear during the day. But that's a nice thing to be involved in. Last year, 2,000 people signed up for it. So IrishHedgehogSurvey.com. IrishHedgehogSurvey.com. While we're on surveys and that sort of thing, we were telling you last week about Dublin Bus looking for a nickname for their new recovery truck. Dragon Wagon, Anna Liffey, Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Broken Bus Machiney. See, I just, the only reason I'm talking about it is I like saying that. Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Broken Bus Machiney. And the final one was Bus Bedale. And the vote is in. And the people on Twitter, the Twitterati, have decided that the name should be, drum roll, Bus Bedale, which is my favourite on the day. So that's Bus Bedale. Well done, everybody who came up with that and voted on it, etc., etc., etc. Do you know what? I'll bring your attention to, and I won't talk too much about it because it's somebody else's story, but it's there in the Irish Times today. And I know it's, I suppose, a problem for a lot of people around the country, particularly in lockdown. And it's the subject of loneliness. And Rosita Boland, who is a brilliant journalist, writes about her own loneliness, which is a very personal thing. And she even says in the article that admitting to feeling lonely, I feel I'm failing in some way. And she talks about, you know, enjoying your own company, as I've always done, doesn't mean you never get lonely. But now, to be frank, I'm sick of my own company after spending more weeks and months alone in lockdown than I can bear to count. There's no choice. And that's a big word there, an important word. There's no choice involved in spending all this time by myself and entertaining and all as I am. I'd quite like a break for myself at this point. And this is the thing which a lot of people have told me about the Zoom and the FaceTime and the WhatsApp. And she talks about that. At the start of all this, like many others, I used Zoom and FaceTime and WhatsApp to stay in touch with people. In touch is a misnomer, she says, as of course, we were not actually touching at all. Those video calls did help and they still do, but not as much as you might think. The truth is, when the calls end, it's still just me in the room alone in my house. Anyway, it's there. The full article is there. And it's well worth a read. And we might come back to that tomorrow or the day after. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Dr. Aminulla Desundi is going to join us in about 10 minutes' time or so. Aminulla is the head of the religious department at UCC, University College Cork. And he's also a senior lecturer in contemporary Islam. And you know, Ramadan started last week, so we're going to be talking to him about Ramadan. And also, in just reading about him, he feels that a lot of Irish people don't know enough about Islam. And he says the easiest way for people to find out is to ask questions. And it doesn't matter how stupid you think the question is. If you need to know or think you want to know something about Islam and the Muslim faith, well, get them into us and we will put them to Aminulla, and let it be, as well as find out about him, let it be a sort of a fact-finding mission for all of us today. So 51551 for any questions you might have for Aminulla Desundi about his religion. Okay, what else is coming in there? You probably did go to a Meatloaf concert in a hall in Ireland. In the late 80s, Meatloaf was broke and was doing tours of pubs and clubs in Europe. He was actually bottled off the stage in the Oasis in Carrickmacross, says Paddy. And did Meatloaf walk off the stage in Carlow as bottles were thrown at him? I remember reading about this somewhere, says Jimmy. Well, it was obviously in Carrickmacross. Meatloaf, I remember when my sister got her Intercert results in 1981. She asked for an LP as a present. LP, long player. My mother went to the record shop and asked for Bat Out of Hell by Meatball. My poor sister nearly died of embarrassment. Have you got that one by Meatball, please? I was at that Meatloaf concert. It was in Carlow Community Centre. I was approximately 14 in Intercert. So 31 years ago, it was 1991. It was fabulous. No holds barred. Had the blonde and brunette, big haired women, backing singers. Brilliant, says Janice in Kilkenny. And I was at Oasis, sorry, I was at Meatloaf in the Oasis nightclub in Carrickmacross, Monaghan, says Fergal. You see, of course, Meatloaf was the embodiment of Jim Steinman, you know, because neither of them would have existed without each other. I think. And I know Jim Steinman wrote for other people, but Meatloaf was the man who brought his music to most people's attention. I went on a bus from Portlaoise to Meatloaf concert in a community hall in Carlow. Remember eating Rolos while dancing away to Bat Out of Hell. And the excitement in the place when Two Out of Three Ain't Bad was played. No bar, of course. It was great crack, says Emma. That was a big slow side one, wasn't it? Two Out of Three Ain't Bad. Maybe we can talk. Meatloaf did play in Carlow Youth Centre as the status quo. Eric Clapton, Krista Berg, Nancy Griffith, The Waterboys, Chris Rea, etc, etc, etc. Says Paddy Carroll. Is that Paddy Carroll from the music shop in Carlow back in the day? It probably is. Used to DJ in Nijinsky's nightclub in Kildare. And I took over from him on Saturday nights. There you go. Don't feel too bad. It happened to my son with a barber jacket. The sleeves were so narrow, a straw couldn't have fit into them. By the way, Tom is a lovely, cute looking kid. Yeah. Sitting in the sun, knitting, listening to the show, watching the newly arrived swallows, enjoying it all. Bliss, says Heather in Fermoy. Sounds idyllic. You and your knitting and the sun and the swallows and all that. Here we go. This, yeah. Yeah, today is the 21st of April and we have cobbled together 10 questions on events that happened on this day over the years, over the decades, over the centuries, and we're looking for two people to come on and answer five questions each. We have a prize as well. It's from the Heritage in Laois. The Heritage is set in the heart of the countryside in the pretty village of Killinard, just over an hour's drive from Dublin. Enjoy on-site activities like golf, tennis, country walks, or visit the leisure centre or the award-winning spa. The prize is a luxurious two-night break in the Heritage. You and a guest will stay for two nights with breakfast on each morning and dinner on one evening in Blake's. The perfect treat to look forward to, and you can find out more at theheritage.com. To get involved, you have to answer our qualifying question, which is this. Can you name the current Minister for Foreign Affairs? 1850 715 900. That's 1850 715 900. 5 years ago today, we said goodbye to the genius that was Prince. Good afternoon. When doves cry, Prince, who died on this day 5 years. And of course, he lived in Minneapolis, didn't he? Where the Derek Chauvin trial concluded yesterday. 5 on 5 5 1, ray at rte.ie. Same thing happened to me last year in an Echo website. I was looking for a pair of runners, which I had before, sold out everywhere. Until I came across this website. You see, I'm with you now. You go, I've discovered something. That's what you think, I've discovered something. Had my runners in all sizes and cheaper. But again, because it was old stock, I didn't think too much. I thought that's why they're cheaper. No email to track. About 5 weeks later, a pair of something, in inverted commas, arrived. All I could do was put it down to experience. Surely we're not the only two, says Judith O'Keefe. We're not. Same thing happened to me with the runners, but I got a pair of awful socks instead. Always buy Irish now, Galway listener. Somebody else said, we ordered online a 1,000-piece jigsaw last April when all the shops were sold out. It arrived from China about 8 weeks later. The pieces were so tiny, the completed jigsaw would fit on a postcard. Needless to say, we never made it. Yeah, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, more of those if you have them, please. Served meatloaf. You see, served meatloaf. Yeah. Served meatloaf breakfast in bed in a hotel in Isle of Man in 1991. Called him Mr. Loaf. He thought it was hilarious. Probably not the first time he heard it. Also saw him in Carrickmacross the year before, so I was starstruck, says Brenda in Dundalk. 5 on 5 5 1, ray at rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray at rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Thank you very much, Aideen Gormley. You've set our next item up nicely for us. Sunday night is Oscar night and there's huge excitement in a small town in Iceland this week. If you've seen Will Ferrell's Eurovision movie on Netflix, you'll know why. It's a great movie, great laugh. It's called The Story of Fire Saga and it's set in the real Icelandic town of Húsavík. And Húsavík is also the name of a song from the movie which is nominated for Best Original Song at the Academy Awards. Here's a blast of it.
Just to realise that I was meant to stay. Where the mountains sing through the screams of seagulls. Where the whales can't live cause the gentle people in my hometown. My hometown. Thought I made it clear, do I have to say it? It was always there, we just didn't see it. All I need
Húsavík is the hometown in question. So all eyes are on Húsavík this Sunday, and I'm joined now from there by the mayor of the town, Christian Magnusson. How are you doing, Christian?
Good. How are you?
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise.
How are things in Húsavík?
We are extremely excited, as you've probably seen in media in the past couple of days.
Yeah.
It's been quite the adventure for us up here.
Okay. Paint a picture for us. Whereabouts in Iceland are you?
We are on the northeast coast of Iceland in a small town called Húsavík. It's about 6-hour drive from the main city, Reykjavík.
Yeah.
So we're up there.
A population of what, Christian?
In town, about 2,300 people.
All right. So it's a small town. Yeah.
It is a small town.
And why was Húsavík chosen for the movie?
Húsavík was chosen, it's quite the story, actually. I was told that the composers or those who made wrote the song, the Húsavík song, they had written the song before they finished writing the screenplay for the movie. And they were scouting out places in Iceland to shoot the film. Many of them have really difficult names.
I know.
So I think Húsavík played a part in that. It's relatively easy to say.
So it was pronounceable. That's why it was chosen.
Part of it was that. I'm quite sure.
That's pretty. No, because we had one of your fellow countrymen on a few weeks ago about that the eruption of the volcano.
Right.
And I had spent half the day practicing the pronunciation of the volcano.
And
I did my best for him, and he said that was terrible.
No, but
what was the name of that? What was the name of that volcano? The most recent one?
Eyjafjallajökull.
Yeah, exactly.
The big one. Yeah, yeah.
No,
yeah,
not the one. Not the one with the ash now. The one with the lava.
That is ongoing now. You mean?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
What's the name of that one?
It's difficult to pronounce that.
Yeah, it is difficult.
Well. Yeah,
it is difficult, right? Okay. Anyway, back to the Oscars on Sunday night. Where will people watch it, or what's the story with lockdown and restrictions?
It's probably and most definitely going to be family night up here in Húsavík and rest of Iceland. There are restrictions. We cannot gather more than 20 people in one room, so it's gonna be hefty to have a big old party at this point in time. But I'm sure that we will celebrate either way. First day of this lockdown being over.
Yes,
and,
of course. You will. Can I ask you about Will Ferrell?
Yeah,
did you meet him?
I did. Yeah,
he's a lovely guy, isn't he?
He is a tremendous guy.
Yeah,
And was absolutely wonderful when he came to visit, and the entire cast really, they were also fond of the town, and probably just because they weren't bothered all that much. People weren't screaming behaving in the usual way, I think, elsewhere where these people travel.
Yeah. So, like, it's been lockdown, so, you know, obviously you're not seeing the benefits of the movie yet, but do you expect that there will be an increase in tourists? Because people who are into the Eurovision are really into the Eurovision, so I would imagine they'll be travelling to see Húsavík, will they?
Yeah, that's what we're hoping for. We do rely heavily on tourism industry, and it was partly a joke when I was referring to the name of the town, because we have Húsavík as sort of the main whale watching capital in the country. So about 100,000 people come just to whale watch whales in the summertime.
Right.
From Húsavík, so that is also plays a part in the movie and the song, of course, where the whales live.
Yes, yeah.
So
and Christian,
we're hoping that people come when this is over with.
Are you an elected public representative, or what way does it work?
I am, yes.
You are, okay.
I am.
And do you have a full-time job as well, or is being the mayor the full-time job?
No, that's the full-time job. That's the full-time job.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Well, good luck to everybody in Húsavík. This Sunday, the song Húsavík is nominated for Best Original Song at the Academy Awards. It's up against stiff competition, but we'll cross our fingers for you, Christian.
Thank you very much. I sincerely hope that Húsavík becomes everybody's hometown.
Good talking to you. See you, Christian. Bye,
right.
Bye, bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
We're looking for two people to take part in our quiz after 4 o'clock. Our qualifying question today, can you name the current Minister for Foreign Affairs? 1850 715 900. That's 1850 715 900. And we have a lovely weekend away in the Heritage in Killinard in County Laois to give away today. So that's 1850 715 900, the current Minister for Foreign Affairs. Now, Muslims in Ireland, of which there are between 65 and 70,000, are now 1 week into the holy month of Ramadan. So today we're going to chat with one man who's observing Ramadan. That's Aminullah Dasandi. Aminullah is based in Cork. He's the head of the religious department in UCC, and he's also a senior lecturer in contemporary Islam. Good afternoon, Aminullah.
Hi, Lee. How are you?
Good to talk to you. Thanks for taking time out to talk to us. So you are in the middle of a day of fasting.
Yeah.
Okay. And that started at what time?
Too early. if I could just kind of go through the typical day, because what would seem like in the middle of the night, you basically stuff your face and then you spend the entire day without food and drink. Now, you are supposed to contemplate God and draw closer to God through spirituality. But some of us might actually be thinking about what we're going to have when we break our fast. So, you know, you might spend a couple of hours in the evening thinking about what you're going to eat, and then you just go and do the exact same thing the day after.
I was looking at
map. There are some people who don't. I mean, obviously, you know, if you're ill, or you know, you have a reason for not fasting, then it's not supposed to kill you.
Yeah, I was looking at a map of the world, and I think there's 17 hours of fasting in Ireland or thereabouts.
Yeah,
that'd be right, right?
And it's very long.
And is it 40 days? Is it or 30 days?
30. So 30 it's a
days.
Month.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And can you just tell us the history of it?
In the Quran, which is the text that Muslims believe in, it says, you know, fasting is prescribed for you as it was prescribed for those before you, so that you may attain God consciousness. And when it talks about those before you, it's actually linking to Jews and Christians. Some say it's Jews and Christians in terms of the significance of fasting that was kind of started through biblical monotheism. So it's a spiritual kind of a ritual, which is to not have anything in your belly in order to, you know, draw closer to God and to think more carefully about your actions and think about virtues and morality as you're doing that. But it is, as I tell my students all the time, it is an extension of what is within Judaism and Christianity in terms of the significance of fasting. Now, of course, within Judaism, Christianity, the idea of fasting has changed, it evolves, but within the Islamic tradition, you still have, you know, this idea of fasting from food and drink from sunrise until sunset.
And is it strictly policed?
Well, again, see, it's about drawing closer to God, and you know, faith is such a grey area. It is something that can't be replicated from one Muslim to the other, which means that it's really up to you. So that means that, you know, you will have Muslims who'll be fasting the entire 30 days. You might have a Muslim who says, you know what, I'm going to fast today. I'm going to, I might miss it tomorrow. So it's really about personal relationships. Okay. I always joke to my students about the fact that anybody can go into the toilet and have a banana.
Right.
I'm sorry to make it.
Do you? But it just, do you go? Just, do you? The odd time. go into the toilet and have a banana?
No, not at all. Okay. I just meant that each individual's piety and faith is very different.
Of course,
you know, yeah. I'm one of my favourite poets is this irreverent 19th century Mughal Indian poet who was a complete drunk. You know, you would compare him to someone like Robert Burns, and he was very, very open about the fact that he didn't want to fast, but he was adamant that he was Muslim. And I think that type of, you know, character, we very rarely see or hear of a Muslim in that way,
yeah,
because we box Muslims too easily into what a Muslim should look like or what they should and shouldn't be doing.
Well, let's try and change that a little bit in the next 20 minutes or so, Amanullah. So first, let's find out a little bit about you and how you ended up in Cork. That's a Scottish accent, I hear.
It is. I'm a proud Glaswegian.
Okay, and your parents are originally from...
From Pakistan, Sialkot in the Punjab area.
Okay. And what's your family situation? What did your dad and mom do? How many children, etc.?
My dad was the only son of many daughters, sisters, and the onus was on him of going out and making money. So he travelled around a lot. He left Pakistan quite early and ended up in Hong Kong, Singapore, Yugoslavia, Germany, and then ended up in the UK. In between all of this, he married my mother. They're from neighbouring villages.
Right.
So that was basically the story. My dad came to the UK in the 50s. My mum in around about the 60s. And my dad did kind of menial, jobs. He was doing bread making, thread making, ended up running a corner shop in the south side of Glasgow for about 20 to 23 years. My father passed in 2010.
Oh, right.
My mother's still in Glasgow.
And Glasgow, of course, the divisions between Catholics and Protestants are well documented. You lived in a Jewish neighbourhood.
My dad's shop was in a Jewish neighbourhood.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So you had all sorts of religions going on around you when you were growing up?
Absolutely. It was just, you know, I haven't even had enough time to reflect on what I went through. Like, you know, at home, my mum was adamant. Because my mum has very limited English. She would say, you know, you're not allowed to speak English at home. You're only allowed to speak Punjabi. And, you know, so we spoke Punjabi at home. My dad was he had a corner shop, but he was suited and booted. He used to go to the shop, you know, dressed very smartly, and it was just being part of that very kind of dazzling mix of West of Scotland sectarian divisions between Glasgow Rangers and Glasgow Celtic. And then, you know, at home, listening to my mum talking about how she bathed with buffaloes in her village was just something for me was quite beautiful. But the family was, we're a laugh-a-minute family. Everything was always tongue-in-cheek, taking the piss out of each other,
right,
which was amazing. And I think that's what really, you know, made me quite comfortable with religion.
Right. Explain that to me. You don't take it too seriously, is that it? Or
it was just I think the connection between religion and humour is just so close. You know, it was like my mother used to say to my dad, right, it's time for prayer, we need to pray. And my dad would go and start singing the most erotic Bollywood songs to her. And we would be sitting there going, what on earth is going on? And I think in some way there was always a balance. There was always this beautiful balance between something that's very, very serious, and on the other side you could just, you know, absolute have a laugh about it. So that was what made me very comfortable. But my Islam is very much connected with my parents' Pakistani-ness,
yes,
if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And so,
cultural,
can't really separate.
Cultural.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just can't separate it. Like, it, you know, at some level, I mean, I talk to my students here and who tell me, oh, you know, I don't know whether I'm Catholic anymore. And then they kind of start talking about what it means to them to be Irish. And I think, gosh, it's exactly the same about what I talk about when I talk about being Glaswegian, being Pakistani.
But they're not one and the same thing, Amanullah. Like, your culture and your religion are separate things.
I don't know. This is, I mean, I'm not sure. I just think
okay,
that,
well, there you go. Well, what do you think then?
I just think there's the way in which the rhythm of our society has so much religion crept into it. You know, it's very difficult to separate it. But I think we live at a time where it's very clear cut. We're at a time of Instagram and, you know, Twitter and so it's give me the absolute clear cut religion and secularism. That's and I'm just like, what does that mean? How do you create something that's completely secular or completely I don't know.
My understanding of secularism is not that it's devoid of religion, but I suppose it's that religion has less power. It's if maybe the way you could say it is it's indifferent to religion.
Right. I do like that. I think what is important there is that is pluralism. So I'm really quite, you know, I get very excited about pluralism because I think what we need is I love the diversity of thought. I love somebody coming up to me and saying, you know, I'm kind of culturally, I mean, or whatever way you want to say it, Muslim, but maybe I don't really believe in God. And I just find that absolutely fascinating.
Now, what do you say when somebody says that to you?
I just say, that's great. What does that mean for you? You know, I just think it's absolutely wonderful. But the problem is that we're so busy damning people to hell these days that we don't take time to reflect on individuals. And religion can be weaponized in many different ways.
It has been throughout history.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it can start a liberation movement or it can absolutely, you know, kind of kill people.
Well, sectarianism is the, you know, we're very close to it here. Mm. So you, from an early age, questioned religion, but yet you're still religious. So the questioning, you obviously got answers then.
I did, and or I had good enough teachers who kind of kept me thinking. You know, I still remember I used to go to the equivalent of a Sunday school, which was an Islamic school, and I once asked the imam, I was just like, what if we're doing all these prayers and fasting for nothing? What if God doesn't exist? And I think back and I think, gosh, I was really brave in asking that question. And I had a really lovely imam who talked me through about ethics and, you know, having a focus of doing good things. And maybe the idea of heaven is a good idea that makes people do good things. And if God doesn't exist, then at least all of this goodness, you know, won't go in vain. And right. I just sat there and I thought, gosh, that, you know, I think back and I think I was very lucky to have an imam. I mean, I'm sure there are many imams.
Do you think, Emanuela, that if we didn't have the lure of a heaven and the deterrent of a hell, like, we wouldn't be barbaric? I think we're hardwired to be good.
I don't know. I mean, this goes back to a lot of the questions that my students ask. Do we need Judaism, Christianity, or Islam to be good people? Yes. And I'm like, look, everybody has their own path. Everybody tries to, you know, answer the three ultimate questions: where did I come from? What am I doing here? Where am I going to end up? Right. And you find those answers in a multitude of different ways. For me, Islam works. For somebody, it could be, none of this works. I just kind of find my way and. And I think that's beautiful. And I think that's what makes our society so bright and prosperous. But I do worry that we're losing sight of that, of being able to appreciate all those differences, that we become so angry at times with people who think differently from us.
So we have to listen. So a little bit back to your life story then. You're in Cork since 2015. Yeah. How did you end up in Cork?
I did my PhD in Glasgow, finished in 2009, and then I moved to the States for 6 years. So I taught for 1 year in upstate New York, and then I lived for 5 years in South Beach on Ocean and Third, and I taught at the University of Miami. And I just kind of got a wee bit tired of being at the beach all the time. I mean, I kind of thought, when's the party going to end? And I remember coming back to Glasgow one summer and my mum going, you know, it's all great that you got this job in Miami and you live at the beach and all that, but can you not come a little bit closer to Glasgow? And I went online and I just saw that there was a job up at UCC, and I applied. And to be fair, you know, all my mentors were like, you're never going to get that. It's a senior post and you're nowhere near that. And I thought, you know what, I'll just apply. And I got the job. So when I came to Cork, it was absolutely raining. And I thought, gosh, I was very nostalgic at this point after 6 years in the States. And the rain kind of reminded me of Glasgow. And here I am.
And of course, Glasgow is the second city, as is Cork.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are echoes there. And what about, you know, culturally then, Cork and you as a Muslim?
It's been tough. I mean, to be very honest with you, it's been very difficult. There's been times where I thought, what am I doing here? When I first came here, I thought, oh, it's, you know, I wasn't seeing enough people who looked like me. And they, whenever I raised questions about diversity, it was just always, oh, we don't talk about this, or, you know, this is. And I just feel in the last 5 or so years, Ireland has changed so significantly. I mean, Ireland is... I absolutely love being here. You know, the idea of the outward migration has turned to inward migration. But I think, you know, I kind of try to compare what it was like for me growing up in Glasgow. I think a lot of the heavy lifting was done by my parents' generation.
Yes, yes.
You know, my dad.
So we're going through that now. What, yeah, you know what I mean? So
it's like hard.
The UK is way ahead of us. It's probably 30 or 40 years ahead of us when it comes to cultural diversity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we'll get there. You know, I keep saying, because, you know, it's quite nice to come and reflect on your show about all this, because normally I'm wheeled out to talk about, you know, really difficult stuff about racism and being anti-racist and just make everybody uncomfortable in the room. But I just kind of think that we are going in the right direction. It's absolutely great to hear, you know, people kind of talking about multiculturalism and what that means for our society. It enriches our society. Mm. Look, people will never agree on this.
Do you think?
But I just think it's a good thing.
Do you think Irish people know enough about your faith? Your faith, sorry.
What surprises me sometimes is that many of my students, when I teach them about Islam, they don't really, it takes them a wee while to appreciate that Islam and Muslims are not a monolith. And by that, I mean that they're not just this 1 billion people mass of individuals who believe in all the same things. So I kind of try to say to my students, look, you understand that there's diversity of Christians, that, right? You have Protestants, Catholics, Methodists, you know, but Islam has exactly the same. And it's like, I come to sometimes think, gosh, it's coming down as quite a shocker. But my students are great. And, you know, I just feel that when they start and then when they come to the end of the course, it's just wonderful. And I just feel so many ideas have been broken down.
Yeah.
Look, when I teach, I'm not teaching them to go away thinking Islam is a religion of peace. That's not my job. My job is to make them think critically, to think that there are good Muslims, there are bad Muslims. Islam has certain aspects of history which are good and certain aspects of its history which aren't good. And I think once you have that lovely picture, I mean, it's not a lovely picture, but you know what I mean, once you have that complicated picture, it just puts us all at a bit more ease to see we're actually not that different from each other.
But what do you think are the common misconceptions about the negative aspects of Muslims?
I think a lot of the misconceptions are... one thing I feel is that Islam is often not associated with Judaism and Christianity, whereas it should be. I sometimes joke to my students, I said, you can't really separate them. They've been in bed with each other for a very, very long time. And it's because they all believe in that monotheistic biblical God. That's why I recently wrote a book with my former colleagues from Miami on this and an introduction to monotheism. So that was kind of key for me in building bridges.
So we all worship the same God.
I believe that. You'll have many people who will not believe that as well.
Yeah.
I think also more on the intra-diversity. Like, I just think that we kind of box Muslims in a very clear way. Look, you have that ideal, you know, husband, wife, 2.4 children, whatever that means. But you've also got queer Muslims. You've got, you know, all of that diversity exists within Islam. And you have all the same tensions about, you know, challenging authority and trying to find space for women, etc. within, you know, mosques. So
but
all
a man sat in front of me here, a member of the Irish Muslim community, and told me that in his view, that homosexuality was a sin.
Well, again, it's, you know, religion is all about interpretation. So it depends on the interpretation. You know, I saw a tweet just the other day by one of the biggest LGBT Muslim organisations in the UK. And they were saying, you know, Ramadan is a very difficult time for queer Muslims because, you know, they're often fighting the double bind of Islamophobia and homophobia. And it just kind of made me think about how difficult a time it must be. And exactly the same kind of conversations that we've had here, you know, when it comes to talking about, you know, same-sex marriage and all of that, but it's not.
Would you
different.
Think though that you know, the UK are ahead of us when it comes to cultural and ethnic diversity? Do you think that, like, Catholicism is slightly ahead of Muslim when it comes to, you know, attitudes to women and attitudes to homosexuals?
It's all about who you ask, Ray. You know, you could sit with somebody who'll say no, and they'll just keep saying no to everything. And you'll meet somebody who's completely open. You might even meet a Muslim woman who's led prayers. You know, I just think that diversity exists. And a lot of these are happening in conversation with each other. You know, there was a ton of religious leaders who came together and spoke up against conversion therapy. You know, and there was Muslims there. You know, who said this is, you know,
this is the cure, the gayness.
Yeah, yeah, and right. I just think, you know, that gives us a lot of hope in terms of appreciating that diversity. One size doesn't fit all. And I'm not saying, I think what we need to do is we need to just appreciate that internal diversity, which is for me is really, really quite beautiful. Maybe I've got too much privilege at the university. I enjoy a good argument or a good discussion. But you also
in a way, you're sort of preaching to the converted, excuse the terrible pun, but they're there to study religion, so they're going to listen to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great to hear. Amanullah Sunday on the show. He's an exceptional colleague in UCC and constantly promotes tolerance, inclusivity and peace, says Ger. That's the chaplain down in UCC.
I didn't pay him to say that, by the way.
Yeah, right. As a retired member of the Irish Defence Forces, our service with the UN in Lebanon did educate us in the Muslim culture. They have a call to prayer. A Catholic church here has the Angelus. Muslims have Ramadan. We have Lent. We are not that far apart. Amazing culture, and the Lebanese are amazing people, says Seamus. And can you please ask your guest, who are the main people who are also in the Christian and Jewish religions? I know the three religions are collectively known as Abrahamic religions, but is Jesus and Mary and the apostles part of the Islamic teachings? Vinny wants
yes,
to know.
Yes, they are. In short, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So Jesus is considered as a prophet in Islam. And Muslims also believe in the Immaculate Conception.
Yeah.
I was driving can the I, other
can
day,
I, can
actually.
I ask you, well, I have you on, just like life before religion.
Uh-huh.
Man lived before religion was invented.
Uh-huh.
Did he?
Did man exist?
Humans existed before religions existed.
Where are you taking me with that question?
No. Well, the reason, some people describe maybe we're entering into a post-religious society.
Look, you know what it is? The way I think about it is, set aside all of the ideas that we have about religion, because I think when we say religion, something happens in people's minds. They start thinking about stuff, and we've been programmed at some level to think about religion. When I say Islam, right, I don't know whether you think of peace and tolerance, but when I say Buddhism, or I talk about, you know, yes, the Dalai Lama, but set that all aside for a second, and I keep going back, and I always say this to my students, look, we've got three ultimate questions that I think any human being is going to continually
give
ask
us them again.
Where did I come from? What am I doing here? Where am I going to end up? And the answers to those are absolutely beautiful. Let's revel in that diversity.
So we're driven, but here's the thing, we're driven to answer those questions. Aren't we? We're sort of, it's in our DNA to find answers to those questions.
At some level, some people might not want to spend time thinking about them though.
Yeah. But what I'm getting at is that sort of religion fills that sort of void, if you like.
Yes, and religion offers hope. Look, we're going through a pandemic where we're bombarded with numbers and figures and this and that. Where am I going to get my hope? I love scientists, and scientists are helping me through the pandemic. Uh-huh. But hope comes from, you know, your arts, your culture, your religious stories, any way that you want. I get hope from all of that, from music that makes you just think. So there's a lot of goodness in religion. We just have to expand our understanding of the word.
We leave it on a positive note. We were speaking to Professor Brendan Kelly last week on his book, The Science of Happiness, and people who have a strong religious belief are happier than people who don't. So there you go. He's gone.
Thank you, Ray.
Okay, right. Dr. Amanullah Dasandi, thank you very much.
But let me just say, finally, there are probably a lot of people who don't follow any systematic kind of religion who live very full and happy lives. So I think I just want to...
That'd be me.
I think we just have to appreciate that. It's all about meaning and making meaning of our life. And hopefully we're all driven towards love and peace and drawing closer to each other and understanding that we're not really that different.
Okay. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I'm sure we'll talk again. Thank you, Amanullah. Thank you very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
An inch tosh in on the fifth skeleton and octa le mora de wallish. Gramagad mora, thank you very much. 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. If Ray wants to follow up on his interview about Islam, may I suggest he talk to Robert Wright, who has written The Evolution of God, a book that puts Christianity, Islam and Judaism under the microscope and shows how trade, commerce and politics shape the development and acceptance of those three religions. Ray would find the answers to a lot of the questions he has about religion and how it shapes society, says Joe Taylor. Thanks, Joe. And I lived in Kuwait, says Colm, for 12 years and found the Sharia law led to a very safe society. I did have an issue, however, with the status of women in a Sharia court. For instance, a woman's testimony isn't equal to that of a man. And in relation to Ramadan, says Frank, could you please ask the guest what gift I can give to a family at the end of Ramadan? Well, he's gone now. Sorry about that. But we will speak to him again. And maybe we might put that question to him again and answer for you for tomorrow. So sad to hear the death of Jim Steinman. He and Meatloaf were the soundtrack to my youth. Bat Out of Hell was the only album we had on a school tour in 1979 to Lourdes. We went by coach from Holy Faith, Finglas. Still in touch with the girls from my class. And when we meet up, we can still belt out Paradise by the Dashboard Light. Wow, word for word. And that's a long one. I think it's over 6 minutes long. So please say hi to all the lovely ladies from LC1 St. Michael's Holy Faith. Thanks. That's Emer Bambrick from Swords. Paradise by the Dashboard Light. What a great song. And shopping online, I also ordered a cordless drill set that looked too good to be true in hindsight and received what is more like a sewing kit. Again, couldn't track it, couldn't send it back, says Sean. Yeah, buyer beware. And if it seems too good to be true, it is too good to be true. Yes. We hear these words, but we don't act on them. Now, today, 21st of April, and we've probably got 10 questions on events that happened on this day over the years. And we have a prize. A luxurious two-night break in the Heritage, which is set in the heart of the countryside in the pretty village of Killinard, which is just over an hour's drive from Dublin. It's a two-night stay, as I say. Breakfast on each morning, dinner one evening in Blake's. You can find out more at theheritage.com. Oliver Sexton, good afternoon.
Hello, Ray. How's things?
Great. You're over in Enniscrone in County Sligo.
That's right, Ray, yeah.
Is that where David McGowan has his aeroplane?
Yeah, it is indeed, yeah.
Right, yeah. I did a disco up there years ago. What was the name? Right. Was there a nightclub there, you know, in a hotel? I have a vague memory of it.
There possibly would be. I'm a blowing. I'm a Clareman originally.
Oh, are you? Right.
I'm near Enniscrone the last 16 years or so.
And what brought you to Enniscrone?
Work. I suppose work initially and then my wife then, so.
Right. And what do you work at?
I'm a teacher.
Primary or secondary?
I'm a secondary school teacher in a place called Ballisadare.
Right. And what do you teach?
I teach English and history.
Great. And I'd say you're over the moon to be back in.
Ah, it's great to be back, Ray. All right. I think it's great for everybody.
It's just like the homeschooling thing was a huge challenge for everybody involved, I'd say.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's fine short term. I think it worked short term, but the longer it went on, the more difficult it is for everybody involved.
Yeah. Are you involved in the new junior cert curriculum?
Yeah, sure. Everybody is. Yeah.
Everybody is. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because we have somebody at home doing a case, and you know the CBAs. What does that stand for again?
The classroom-based assessment.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So they have to do little projects and little presentations.
They have to do a little project in second year, another one again in third year. Yeah.
Yeah, which like is great. It's a great life skill to be able to get up in front of a class. And,
it definitely isn't is. It? Yeah. It definitely is. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your story at home, Oliver?
Yeah, I'm married to Taryn and we've with three kids. Kyle is 12, Jack is 9 and Ellie is 7.
Right, so a busy enough house.
Busy enough house, yeah, although I think they're at the age now that they can kind of take care of themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they can get up and turn on the telly and pour themselves a bowl of cornflakes. That's it exactly. That's a big moment. People may not appreciate that if they don't have children, but it is a big moment, isn't it, when that happens?
It is, surely, definitely, yeah.
Do you listen to the quiz?
Occasionally, if I'm in the car, I do. And well, if I'm not,
you know how it works anyway.
Today, so
you know
I do indeed. Yeah,
okay, right.
Indeed, yeah.
You're up against Miranda Brennan in Cork City. How are you doing, Miranda?
Oh, hi, Ray. Hi, Oliver.
Hello, Miranda. How are you?
I forgot to ask Oliver what the weather's like in Enniscrone. What's it like in Cork?
Beautiful, gorgeous, sunny day.
And Enniscrone?
It's lovely as well here, Ray.
Right.
Yeah,
good,
beautiful
good,
day. Yeah.
Good to hear. What are you up to, Miranda?
Just after collecting the kids from the school run.
Right, and how many and what ages?
Two boys, 7 and 8, they're listening in the kitchen with their dad, Alan.
What are their names?
Their names are Sean and Dara.
Oh, Sean and Dara, you said that, right. Okay. Yeah. You don't meet many Mirandas.
No.
So why and where and did they explain it to you?
Once was I called after a pop star, but my mom did the Tempest for her, Intercert at the time? And Miranda is Tempest, so Shakespeare.
So you're named after Shakespearean character?
Yeah.
All right. Not after Miranda Hart. Isn't that her name? The tall comedian woman. She's very funny. Yeah. So both of you are off work because of COVID. So how have you been occupying your time?
Keep saying. we've been homeschooling the two boys, so that's passed a lot of time. Yeah. And I guess just keeping the house.
Yeah, it's a very poor line. Will we try and get Miranda on the better line than that? Okay. Okay, I'll give out the rules and we'll try and get Miranda on a better line. So it's 5 questions each. Whoever answers most correct gets the prize. If it's a draw at the end of the 5 questions, we go to a tiebreak situation. So good luck to Oliver and good luck to Miranda. And here we go. Right, Oliver, first question for you. On this day in 1961, the French army revolted in Algeria. On what continent would you find Algeria?
You'd find Algeria in Africa.
You would indeed. Miranda, you're there.
Yes.
Great, you sound a lot better now. On this day in 1929, the first non-stop England to India flight took off. On what continent would you find India?
Asia.
Correct answer. Oliver, audio one for you. Have a listen to this.
They've got a spider baby.
A what?
A spider baby. You know, it's kind of a freak show thing, you know. It's got the body of a spider, but it's actually a baby.
How is it a baby? Does it have a nappy on it or something?
No.
Well, does it have the head of a baby?
No.
Sorry. On this day in 1995, that sitcom starring Dermot Morgan premiered on Channel 4. Can you name it?
Father Ted.
It's correct. That's very funny. Miranda, an audio one for you as well. Have a listen to this.
Strong, handsome, face of a leader.
Does Arthur look like a king or what?
Sorry.
Oh, did you just say you were looking for Arthur?
That information is on a need-to-know basis.
It's top secret. Hushity hush.
On this day in 2010, Miranda, the fourth film in that animated franchise with voices by Mike Myers, Cameron Diaz and Eddie Murphy premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. Can you name the franchise?
Shrek.
Shrek, correct answer. Oliver, third question for you. On this day in 2013, Horacio Cartes was elected president of Paraguay. Which of these is the capital of Paraguay? Asuncion or Lima?
Asuncion.
Is the correct answer. Lima is the capital of Peru. Miranda, on this day in 1977, Zia Ur Rahman was appointed president of Bangladesh. Which of these is the capital of Bangladesh? Dhaka or Kathmandu?
Capital of?
Bangladesh. Is it Dhaka or Kathmandu?
Oh, Dhaka.
Correct answer. Kathmandu is capital of Nepal. Have a listen to this, Oliver.
Yeah. It must be love, love, love.
On this day in 1958, Mike Barson, keyboardist with that group, was born. Can you name the group?
Pet Shop Boys.
It's not. It's Madness.
Yeah.
Madness. Let's call it Madness. Okay. Miranda, chance for you to go in front. Have a listen to this.
It's Friday.
On this day in 1959, Robert Smith, guitarist and vocalist with that group, was born in Blackpool, England. Can you name the group?
The Cure.
Cure is correct. Were you a Cure head back in the day?
No, not really.
Right, okay. Oliver, you're on 3. Miranda, you're on 4. So, Oliver, you need to get this one right to be in with a chance. And then cross your fingers that Miranda gets her final question incorrect. Here we go. On this day in 2002, at the 48th BAFTAs, John Travolta was nominated for a Best Actor Award for his role in Pulp Fiction. In what year was John Travolta born? 1950, 1954 or 1958?
1954.
Is the correct answer? Yes, you're still in. February 18th, 1954, he's 67. Now, Miranda, if you get this right, you walk away with the prize. Get it wrong, and it brings us to a tie-break situation. Good luck with this. Still with the 48 BAFTAs on this day in 2002, Tom Hanks was also nominated for a Best Actor Award for his role in Forrest Gump. In what year was Tom Hanks born? 1952, 1956 or 1960?
In 1960.
No, it was 1956. Which means we're even. So it brings us to a tie-break situation. He was born in 1956, which makes him 64. We asked you the tie-break question before you went on air. And I'll just repeat it to you. On this day in 1874, Walter Wilson, mechanical engineer and designer of cars and tanks, was born in Blackrock in County Dublin. According to Google Maps, how long would it take to cycle from Blackrock to Dundalk? So Blackrock in County Dublin to Dundalk in County Louth. The answer is in hours and minutes. Oliver, can you remember what you guessed?
I think it's 3 hours 30.
You did, 3 hours and 30 minutes. It's 91 kilometres. What did you guess, Miranda?
2 hours 45.
2 hours 45. The correct answer is 4 hours and 52 minutes.
Oh,
sorry, Miranda.
Oh, well done, Oliver.
Hard luck, Miranda.
Miranda, we'll send you out a couple of Ray Darcy Show mugs.
Oh, my boys would be delighted with that.
Great.
Thanks anyway.
Yeah, mind yourself. Great talking.
Take
care. Stay safe. Bye now. Bye. Bye. Oliver, you're off to the Heritage in Killinard.
Great.
When all this is over. Luxurious two-night break.
Sounds good.
It does sound good, yeah. And you can whet your appetite by going to theheritage.com to see what's
great
in store for you. Great talking to you, Oliver. Mind
thanks
yourself.
Thanks a million.
See you
great
now.
Bye, thanks bye, a million. Bye, take bye, care. Bye-bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
We got on to Amanullah about that question. Frank in Mullingar wanted to know what sort of a gift he would give somebody, a family, at the end of Ramadan. And Amanullah says something sweet. Example, dates. The ones you can eat, he says. So there you go, dates, something you can eat. The ones you can eat. And somebody else says, really enjoyed the interview with Amanullah. I'm a religion teacher in secondary school and we're all the time trying to teach about tolerance, respect and diversity. Students of all faiths sit RE for their junior cert. We do not teach it from a Catholic context anymore, but from people of all faiths, including atheists. It's far more inclusive and the subjects aim to teach students about humans and how we have evolved through time, says that person. And buying stuff online, Mary was on from Mayo. This is like confessional here. Ray, I did a really, really stupid thing on Sunday. A post popped up on Facebook saying this company in America was having a liquidation sale. So I succumbed and signed up for it. Paid €35 for electrical stuff. A bit like a raffle. You get whatever they send you. After sending off my money via PayPal, I got cold feet and decided to cancel the order. However, they said the package was already sent. Ah, they're very efficient, weren't they? I'm a bit suspicious because on their reply, there is Chinese symbols, or there are Chinese symbols. I might get a surprise when whatever arrives. I couldn't, haven't told my husband. Whenever whatever arrives, I will let you know. I'm intrigued, Mary. Do let us know. And as always, if it seems too good to be true, it is too good to be true. Now, 51551 ray@rte.ie. Some new music from Imelda May. 11 past the hour is the new album from Imelda May. And that's Don't Let Me Stand On My Own, a duet with Niall McNamee. Not the awfully footballer. The other Niall McNamee, the Irish singer-songwriter and actor. Says here he's star of stage, film and rambunctious sing-alongs in taverns up and down the land. He has starred up Sir Pierce Brosnan, fought with Jackie Chan, played comic foil to Bono and romantically duetted with Imelda May, as you just heard. That's Niall McNamee. Now, every so often, we happen upon somebody with a very interesting and unusual job. Kieran Stanley designs zoos. I've never met a zoo designer before. He's originally from Clahean in County Cork and he joins us now from his office in Germany. How are you doing, Kieran?
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Good to talk to you. Thanks for taking time out. You're a busy man.
No problem.
How does one become a zoo designer?
I guess accidentally.
Is it right?
Everything in life, yeah, you fall into things and either you like it or you don't, and then you keep on if you like it. I landed in Hanover in Germany about 1994 after calling a friend of mine after finishing college. And I started working with a practice there that they just got the job. They were commissioned to do the master planning in Hanover, the zoo. And
right.
It became, I guess I fell into it, fell in love with it, because it wasn't just about the architecture. It was about, you know, everything involved in the actual task of designing a zoo. So it's landscape, it's about narrative communication design. It's about taking the visitors on a journey, you know, to Africa, to India, and this kind of thing. So it became a kind of a mix between architecture and scenography, if you will.
What's that second word you used?
Scenography.
What is scenography when it's at home?
Something that those who would be in the theatre, if you're looking, let's say, sitting in the rangs of the theatre and you're looking up and what you see in front of you is somebody's given it thought about what it can look like.
Okay,
what we can,
yes.
It's
yeah.
Basically, it's a form of design. If you
yeah. So because I didn't give much thought to zoo design until today, but in thinking
right.
about it, you have to satisfy a lot of things, don't you? They're like, you know, the animals, obviously, their safety and to make sure they're comfortable. And then, of course, us who come to see the
right.
animals. And so all of that has to be married together in a very clever way. And that's your job.
And the operations.
So and the operations, right. Oh, you didn't think about that. So the feeding of the animals when we're gone or even when we're there.
And caretaking. So it's the animal welfare, basically. There's the zoo. There's usually over about 100 or 200 employees in any middle to large-sized zoo. So that's actually their place of work, and they're looking after the animals, and there's the animals who live there, and then there's the visitors.
Right.
So it's a kind of, yeah, triumvirate of
needs.
Of clients
yeah,
and
yeah,
needs,
yeah.
yeah.
So in the time you've been working, which is probably close on 30 years now, working in various zoos around the world, I'd say you've seen a big change in zoo design.
Well, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, well, I grew up in Cork, but we used to go up to Dublin quite often. And,
yeah.
I mean, Dublin Zoo at that time, I remember coming away crying and thinking, you know, I don't think, you know, that's right, the way we're looking at animals behind cages and they're on exhibition. So I guess there is a huge change. I mean, it's definitely a quantum leap in the right direction. Towards, you know, giving the animals the amount of space and the needs and the environmental enrichment that they need and want. And at the same time, we as visitors have a subjective idea as well that it's, I mean, if the more, I guess you can't tell if an animal is happy or not.
No.
But you can if they're reproducing and procreating. That's usually a good sign. But subjectively, obviously, we think the animal is sad if they're locked up and if they're kept in small spaces. So I guess, you know, somehow it's my job to try to give as much back to the animals as possible and try to somehow take the visitors on a journey there
yeah.
and allow them to engage with the animals as much as
and
possible.
And of course, this is a truism, but I'm going to say it anyway, that you can't ask animals what they want. You know, where would you like that pond? Where, you know, you
well,
can't... But
you can, in a way, by observing,
by observing
the
yes.
natural environments. Yeah, yeah.
yeah,
by,
yeah.
You can observe natural environments. We can take a lot from nature, and transfer. So
okay.
that's what we do. Which we, you know, we try to include as much as possible from as far as the natural environment goes.
Talk to us about the panda, because the panda is famously difficult to get to procreate, etc. And
well,
so,
yeah.
which suggests that they're probably not happy in captivity. But you've designed two panda enclosures, which is mm-hmm. one more than anybody else in the world. Is that correct?
Correct. One
yes.
is in South Korea, one is in Berlin. Well, yeah, I mean, they have a window of opportunity of 72 hours a year where they can... It's a bit like a marriage.
Now, I'd like to distance myself from that last comment.
I'll probably get a slapping now when I get home. But no, the you know, it's basically, it's not that they're not happy there. They're very particular. They're very picky about their partners and their moods and their mood swings. And if it doesn't line up, then there's nothing going to happen.
So how does that colour your design then, that knowledge?
Well, basically you design it so that they can, if the time comes, if suddenly there's signals that she is willing,
mm.
and he is able, then it has to be designed in such a way that they can come together basically very easily and simply.
Right.
So I guess it's about flexibility of the design of the enclosures and of the areas and the environment.
Fascinating, yeah. We'll leave the panda aside now, apart from the panda, which is the most difficult animal to design for when you're designing a zoo?
Yeah, there's a few up there. We're designing an Asian rhino environment right now in the Berlin Zoo, and they're obviously huge animals
yeah.
with a huge amount of strength. So there's a lot of steel and reinforced concrete going in there, But with regard to complexity and it would probably be the polar bear. Polar bear is very, very difficult. At the same time, you can give him a lot. In Hanover, for instance, there's a wave machine that in salt water. We've got fish in there, which it doesn't work in the UK. You can't really use fish as an environmental enrichment element. But in the Hanover Zoo...
Why not? Just,
there's different laws. There's
all right, different laws. Right, okay.
Certain countries have certain laws with regard to feeding live animals or fish to other animals.
Okay.
For instance, in Germany, it doesn't really apply. And so there's a great amount of environmental enrichment elements that we were able to weave into the enclosure, and you could see that they're really using them and playing with them. And so I think we have to really be very clever in what we can give back to their environments and make sure that they're really being challenged, is the word. That it's not giving them a comfort five-star hotel. It's yes. More the opposite. We need to try to understand how to challenge their abilities and then need to weave that in.
And of course, all the time thinking about we want to see them doing whatever they're doing. So
well, that's why you're put on a boat underneath the water in wow. Hanover, for instance. Yeah.
So the polar bear swimming above you, is he? Or she?
Yeah, there's two of them. Yeah, they're in the water, and above you are penguins because they're on board the boat, and then there's seals on the other side of you, so you're completely surrounded by animals.
Wow.
In quite a spectacular way, actually. Yeah, that was a project that we spent a lot of time trying to solve that one.
Right. Look, we've run out of time, unfortunately, because this is a fascinating topic. Kieran Stanley, architect and zoo designer, thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us today. Thanks, Kieran.
You're very welcome, Ray.
Thank you. That's it from us. Cormac and Sarah on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.